It's the 17th of January 2014, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Who's taking sides in the battle over net neutrality? Should assisted dying be used for worthy causes and not just on people I don't like? What's the full story of the atheist asylum seeker? Do life jackets on planes ever actually save lives? Can an all-powerful and all-knowing God be tricked by a piece of wire? And should the NHS share our embarrassing medical data around more than just the staff canteen? Now, we start this week with a question of whether the internet is a level playing field. This week in America, the campaign for net neutrality was dealt a blow in court, a ruling that could have a profound effect on the way we use the internet, even here in Britain. Here's David Eastman with more.
The English law of common carriage states that certain businesses, such as ferry operators, innkeepers, or blacksmiths, should try to serve all customers without discrimination. And although you've probably found that London cabbies aren't that happy to go south of the river after dark, and innkeepers can in fact refuse to serve you if you're drunk, you can sort of think of network neutrality as sort of the internet equivalent of this sort of same law from the Middle Ages. Supporters of network neutrality received a blow this week as, to quote, in a case seen as having profound implications for the future of digital innovation and free speech, the US Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia ruled in favour of broadband giant Verizon following a long-running challenge to the Federal Communications Commission, or the FCC's, rulemaking powers. Well, keen listeners to The Pod Delusion might even remember Sean Ellis's piece on network neutrality back in 2010. Anyway, on one side, the FCC argued that forcing broadband providers to allow equal internet access and bandwidth to all lawful content was a cornerstone of the open internet, and it sort of encouraged this sort of virtual circle, if you like, and keeps infrastructure improvements good for all users. On the other side, broadband carriers like Verizon want to strike commercial deals for juicy content. They want to provide high-speed access and premium material, etc., etc., and they believe that deregulation would simply spur more growth like their own. But I won't go into this any further because some of it digs into American law and some of it doesn't reflect how silly the FCC can be at times. So, what of network neutrality? Well, the internet is, of course, a series of tubes, which carry network packets of information around. These packets have to be routed sometimes, depending on where the network is. The tubes are, of course, owned by private corporations, despite the term public internet. A packet might flow through one private corporation's network into another private corporation's network. Sometimes, of course, they have to work together, a bit like a transfer flight in the airline industry. But it was never going to be long before these internet service providers looked longingly at Google and thought, can we make more money for ourselves? Have we got our snouts fully in the trough? So the concept of the two-tier internet was never going to be far away. In other words, charging people to go a bit faster or to go to more premium material or to get more stuff down the tubes for your benefit. So inevitably, some packets are more equal than others. So the ruling this week would appear to hasten the day when we're going to get faster connections to preferred websites and competitors might find themselves blocked from certain networks. A closer examination might reveal why things are moving this direction. First of all, telcos have been asked to sort of allow equal access to lawful content, apps, services, non-harmful devices, beyond reasonable network throttling. These days, governments are quite happy to blame telecommunication companies for giving unfettered access to the riches of the internet, i.e. animal porn and stuff with children, and things that, from a political point of view, are bad. After PRISM and all the revelations brought from Edward Snowden, it's pretty clear that the guardians that are supposed to be looking after things aren't actually that good. And finally, we also have to have a look at what Mr. and Mrs. Average are actually doing on the internet. It's no longer just browsing a web page or two, it is actually downloading megabytes of data via Netflix. So all in all, network neutrality is still a worthy ideal, but the realities of commercial and political world are beginning to close in on the old Wild West. This is David Eastman reporting for the Pod Delusion, which is a product of the open internet.
Now here's Andy Gault with a deeply personal story of why he supports our friends at the British Humanist Association in their campaign to legalise assisted dying.
It's my dad's birthday today. Normally a happy occasion, but sadly, he's no longer with us. He passed away last October after a 2-year battle with stomach cancer. As you can probably imagine, I've been thinking about him more today than usual. He was a lovely man, and he's really missed, especially when something needs fixing at home. Anyway, Dorset Humanists had Andrew Copson, chair of the BHA, visit last week, and he ran through some of the British Humanist Association's objectives for the year. He gave a great talk, and if my memory serves me correctly, some of the main objectives included campaigning against state-funded faith schools, for humanist marriage, and for the right to have access to assisted dying when appropriate. This would allow those who suffer and endure their existence, as well as the terminally ill, to be able to die in a dignified manner. When I say those who suffer and endure their existence, I refer to people who experience great pain on a daily basis, and people who are victims of locked-in syndrome or other debilitating conditions. I mention this because Dignity in Dying, another organisation who support assisted dying, only campaign for those who are terminally ill. Locked-in syndrome is not terminal, just horrendous. It is where the sufferer still has most or all of their mental faculties, but is unable to move or communicate, except in some cases by moving their eyes. It seems draconian to me that in the 21st century, people who are suffering in such a way cannot be at least offered a way out. I'm not saying they ought to take the offer up. That should be entirely up to them. I expect a lot of doctors would be with me on this one, as it's their job to prolong life, not to prolong death. And I imagine that many of them would like to see people die a lot quicker and in a lot less pain than is current. Some people with terminal or debilitating diseases, for them life is over and all they have to look forward to is death. Mr. Copson said that when surveyed, the public are usually in favour of assisted dying from anything from 70 to 90%, but not enough people in Parliament have had the balls to raise the issue. No one wants to rock the boat, do they? Back to my dad. His cancer meant anything he ate ended up coming back up, and by the last few weeks, even water caused him to vomit. By the time he died, he hadn't eaten anything for at least 6 weeks. His feeding tube had stopped working, and he eventually died from dehydration. He was dragged in and out of hospital, and he was really fed up. If I was him, I think I'd have just wanted to die. I never did ask him if he wanted to die though, because one, it's not an easy question to ask your dad, and two, there's nothing I could have done about it anyway. I don't actually have a clue if he would have accepted the offer if it were presented to him, but at least if it was offered, he would have had that choice. The BHA are currently looking for stories like this to back up their campaign, so if you have one, please email it to info@humanism.org.uk. I'm going to send mine in right now. This has been Andy Gault. Did I mention Bournemouth Skeptics in the pub? Oh yeah, I did. For the Pod Delusion.
There was big news on the atheist scene this week. No, Richard Dawkins didn't tweet about honey again, but there was actual proper interesting news, as an asylum seeker was allowed to stay in the country because he was an atheist facing persecution at home. To explain more, Blakely Nixon has been speaking to Bob Churchill from the International Humanist and Ethical Union, who, as you might expect, knows about these things.
So I'm here with Bob Churchill of the International Humanist and Ethical Union, and I was wondering, Bob, if you can give us a background to this case.
Well, essentially the background is that The Home Office have processed an asylum application from a man from Afghanistan. He originally came to the UK way back in 2007 when he was just 16. And it's now been decided that his asylum case can be accepted. Now, this was widely reported as being the first case of its kind. We don't think that's actually the case. There have been other atheists accepted for asylum as atheists, but it does highlight the issue, which I think is very important, and it may also be the first case argued that way under the Refugee Convention of 1951. But certainly what it does do is highlight that atheism is a serious-minded philosophy, in the words of the council that brought this, and that it is sort of equivalent to a religious or political belief when it comes to freedom of thought, religion or belief legislation.
And how important is this as a precedent?
I think it's a very important precedent for the United Kingdom. It means that our Home Office, when they look at these kind of cases, are going to have that precedent to look back at. But it's also important because obviously all of these asylum applications are made under the same Refugee Convention. So when other countries are now looking at tasked to look at similar asylum applications, they're going to see this as a sort of a precedent. It might not be their legal system, but those lawyers are going to be able to look to our interpretation in this country of what the Refugee Convention commits them to, and hopefully they would similarly say, yep, well, we know under freedom of religion or belief already that atheism is a sufficient worldview to warrant classification in this way. We know that the UK has sort of looked at it and said, yeah, there are countries where it is so difficult, both socially and legally, to say, I am an atheist, that we can grant asylum in these cases. I mean, it should be pointed out that we're talking about, you know, countries here where to be an atheist, having been presumed to be a Muslim from birth, for example, means that you're an apostate and that's punishable by death in a country like Afghanistan anyway. So these are not small beings. This is not people voicing some minor opinion that doesn't really matter. It's something that in the context means they will suffer serious social marginalisation or, you know, outright legal or extra-legal persecution.
So does this represent a shift in general, either within sort of UK law or in international law, a shift in the perception of atheists and non-religious people?
I think so, yeah. I think it would have been very difficult to argue this case, not because the argument was any different, but because the likelihood that it would be accepted, even 10 years ago perhaps, would just have been very different. And I think we've seen a very similar situation developing in asylum law as we have with homosexuality. And it's similar and analogous on a number of levels. It is something that many people intuitively weren't taking seriously. It is something that people criticize on the grounds of, oh, well, what if it's people just pretending to be homosexual or pretending to be an atheist and so on. And it's something that, you know, it's only in the last generation or so that it can be talked about in a serious minded way.
So I guess that brings us on to some of the responses we've had to this decision. There's been a bit of a backlash on Twitter, and there was a Daily Mail comment, for example, saying that now he's got his benefits wrapped up, he's going to head straight into the first mosque. I mean, how have you been responding to these?
Yeah, we saw a few of those. We had someone saying, oh, it sounds like another backdoor into the UK, for example. I mean, obviously, it plays into that general response to immigration where people kind of overinflate the numbers in their own minds. The media does a lot of that for us, obviously.
Entire population of Romania was apparently going to come to the UK.
Course. Exactly. And actually, obviously, well, as I said, there's these analogies to homosexuality and asylum law. And we saw exactly the same thing when a couple of months ago the European Court said, you know, that countries should accept applications from gay asylum seekers if they're coming from countries where that's illegal. So we saw people then saying, oh, there's going to be this huge wave of gay asylum seekers coming into the country and so on. So I sort of looked at this around the time, and really the total number of people in the UK who are either refugee status now or current asylum seekers or stateless individuals, there's a few hundred people who are completely stateless, is less than 1% of the population, 0.3%, something like that. So I think people highly inflate these things, and really, you know, if you're on the border of a country at war and many, many refugees come over all at once, then you can get, you know, genuine social problems just from refugees, just having a large influx of people into a small town, for example. What we're talking about here is one case, the first case of an atheist asylum seeker being granted asylum on that basis. So I don't think this is going to, give the Daily Mail their ammunition that they would like.
I mean, it does seem to raise an interesting question as to how do you prove you're an atheist? But I guess you could say the same. How do you prove you're a Christian, or how do you prove that you're
a communist? No one would dispute that a Christian asylum seeker from Pakistan, say, if they'd been accused of blasphemy or if their family had been harassed, that was something that the Refugee Convention should cover. And no one sort of starts to say to that, well, hang on a minute, how do you know they're Christians? There are things that we can do. Asylum officers are able to assess to some degree what the situation they really come from is. And the same thing will happen here. But the fact is, there are millions upon millions of people living in deeply conservative religious countries. As we talked about the other week on the Pod Delusion, there are 13 countries around the world where you can be put to death for apostasy, so for converting from Islam and giving up religion or converting to another religion. The idea that someone can just say, oh, it sounds like another backdoor into the UK, when we're talking about as a country that legally can stone you to death or hang you for being an atheist, I find really distasteful.
And where can people go to find out more information and, I guess, more importantly, get involved in campaigns like this? Because I'm guessing we've had one case, I'm guessing there's going to be more. So is there any way people can get involved?
Possibly. I mean, obviously we weren't involved in bringing this particular case, but it's something we've been looking at for a little while at IHU. Because we've seen a huge increase in the number of people writing to us from countries where this is highly problematic in the last few years, saying, I'm an atheist, I'm being persecuted here, I'm worried that my family are going to abandon me, and so on. So this will really give us some of the language and the precedent when we are trying to mediate between, for example, an asylum seeker from one country and another country, or indeed into the UK. In terms of where people can find out more information about this sort of thing, I mean, we monitor issues like this at ihu.org, so people can go there. And of course, it's the theme of this, the next World Humanist Congress, being hosted in Oxford by the British Humanist Association this year, is freedom of thought and expression. And obviously, we're looking at that from a sort of humanist perspective. So although it's broadly on the theme of freedom of thought and expression, the freedoms of atheists in deeply religious countries will certainly be one of the strands in the Congress program.
And where can we find out more information about that?
You can find out more information about that at whc2014.org.uk. That's World Humanist Congress 2014.
And on that incredibly contrived plug, thank you very much, Bob Churchill.
All right, thanks.
Now, I know we have at least one listener who always tweets about listening to our show whilst on planes. So, for God's sake, Martin, please don't listen to this next piece if you're in the air. So, how good are the safety gear we're given on the planes? Are life jackets effective? Is there any point in having an oxygen mask? Here's Drew Ray, forcing you to contemplate the inevitability of death.
2014 is likely to be the year when airline flights around the world start taking off without the familiar warning to switch off all electronic devices. It was one of those safety instructions that many people questioned the need for, particularly when it was so often disobeyed without dire consequences. There was, by the way, a legitimate need for the rule. There were plausible ways that personal devices could interfere with navigation, and regulators simply aren't in the habit of allowing potentially dangerous airborne equipment without positive evidence that it's safe, rather than negative evidence that it hasn't killed anyone yet. Still, the instruction is on its way out, and maybe it's time to look at some of the other things they tell you before a plane takes off. Let's start with life jackets. It always puzzles me when they have the demonstration about how to put on a life jacket. If it's complicated enough that I need someone to show me how to do it, what are my chances of remembering the instructions when I'm in the middle of an emergency? There have been post-accident studies and non-accident tests where a dismally small number of passengers correctly put on their life jacket within a reasonable amount of time, and many passengers just give up altogether. The most common problem is, of course, correctly connecting and tightening that damn waist strap. Just as I begin to worry about this problem, I calm myself with the thought that there's virtually no chance of me surviving in an accident which makes me need a life jacket anyway. Passenger jets do not tend to make successful water landings. The typical result is either that everyone dies, or the aircraft comes to rest in very shallow water, where the life jackets aren't relevant. There are three main exceptions to this. On the 2nd of May 1970, ALM Flight 980 was heading from JFK Airport to the Virgin Islands. The flight diverted partway due to poor visibility, but then it resumed on the original course when it looked like the weather had improved. Unfortunately, the official visibility and the actual visibility were somewhat at odds, and it had three attempts at landing and three failures. Eventually, they decided to divert. Their totalizer, the instrument which showed them how much fuel was left, had been behaving erratically, so they decided not to trust it. They did have gauges which showed them how much fuel had been burned. So using these gauges and knowing how much fuel had been put into the plane, they worked out that they had enough fuel for the diversion. They turned out to be wrong. The gauges only showed how much fuel had been burned by the main engines, and a small but significant amount had been used by the auxiliary power. So they had less fuel than they thought that they had. Also, the weather was bad, and that made the plane go slower and use more fuel, and eventually they ditched into the ocean. Shortly before the attempted water landing, passengers were told to put on their life jackets. A lot of passengers had trouble with this, and so people were moving about the cabin and the public address system wasn't working, so they had no notice when the plane actually did hit the water. Some of the passengers and one crew member were actually standing up at the time and were killed pretty much instantly, and other passengers were killed because their seatbelts failed when the plane hit the water. After the ditching, the passengers and crew were in the water for up to 3 hours before rescue was finished. A lot of people died in the crash, but a lot survived as well, and some of them probably owe their lives to the life jackets. On 15 January 2009, an A320 operating as US Airways Flight 1549 departed from LaGuardia Airport in New York, straight into a flock of Canada geese. They didn't have enough time to get back round to the airport, or to hit an alternate airport. So the flight crew, Captain Sullenberger and First Officer Skiles, went for the Hudson River and achieved a near-perfect landing. Now, there's a persistent urban legend that other pilots haven't been able to replicate this feat in simulators. If this legend was actually true, then Sullenberger and Skiles would have made a pretty bad decision in trying to land on the Hudson. In fact, the opposite is true. When presented with the same in-flight emergency, with perfect advance knowledge of exactly what's going to happen, only 8 of 15 pilots managed to land at LaGuardia or New Jersey airports. In contrast, 11 out of 12 pilots in the simulator made a textbook ditching in the Hudson, and the 12th out of 12 made an okay ditching, he just used a different but still adequate technique. So by choosing to ditch, the flight crew made exactly the right decision, the only one that really didn't require a miracle. This isn't to take anything away from them. There's a reason the incident is known as the Miracle on the Hudson. It's the only ever fully successful water landing of a large passenger jet. They did everything right. Having successfully landed and evacuated the plane, the captain and first officer then stayed on board a drifting, sinking airliner to make two further inspections that no one was left behind, before they calmly stepped off onto a New York City ferry. Because everyone survived, we've got very good information about the safety briefings, the evacuation, and the use of life jackets. Of the 150 passengers on board, only 25 reported that they'd actually watched all of the safety briefing, and another 19 reported that they'd watched some of it. 77 passengers retrieved seat cushions during the evacuation, but only 10 got hold of life jackets. The crew passed out a lot of extra life jackets, and a total of 21 passengers ended up with life jackets of some form or another. Now, at the time, safety briefings didn't have to talk about life jackets, unless the plane was actually going over a substantial body of water. And the passengers who used the seat cushions said that they did so because they remembered hearing in previous safety briefings that they could use the cushions for flotation. So even though not many had actually watched the safety briefing this time, obviously regularly hearing the same safety briefings over and over had caused some important information to sink in. Most of the passengers in this case were taken straight onto rafts and all were picked up very quickly by boats. So only a few people ended up totally in the water, and mostly by their own choice because they're afraid the plane would explode. The third accident to talk about here is Ethiopia Airlines Flight 961. It was a botched hijacking that resulted in an unsuccessful water landing, and many of the deaths in this case were actually blamed on the life jackets. Despite the instructions, a lot of passengers inflated their life jackets too early while they were still in the plane, and they couldn't get out of the sinking plane because of their life jackets. So, what about oxygen masks? Every time I hear the pull down firmly to start the oxygen flowing, I imagine myself in an emergency. How hard am I supposed to pull? What if I pull too hard? What if I don't pull hard enough? I'm not going to find out because the bag may not inflate even though oxygen is flowing normally. On May 11, 1996, ValuJet Flight 591 experienced a fire in the cargo hold. Now, the cargo hold's airtight, so that shouldn't be a problem. It should just go out for lack of oxygen. Except the fire started because of an oxygen generating system that was being carried as cargo. It started the fire and it provided it with oxygen. So the whole plane crashed. Maybe not the best example of oxygen masks helping people. Well, what about Aloha Air in 1988? In that case, the same blowout that caused the cabin to depressurize also wiped out the oxygen system. Same thing with a 747 in 1989. Here's a better example. On 7th of October 2000, on a 737 out of Stansted, the flight crew didn't follow the checklist and forgot to make sure that the cabin pressurization system was turned on. At the same time, due to another mistake, the alarm to tell them that the cabin pressurization system was not on was not on. In this case, the oxygen masks fell down, and it was really like a backup warning system to tell the pilots there was a problem. So they returned to the airfield and everything was fine. And as far as I can work out, that's the only time that passenger oxygen masks have saved lives, by acting as a supplementary warning device. There have been plenty of flights where the oxygen masks have deployed, but they're all cases where the plane was already low enough, or got low enough quickly enough, that the oxygen masks didn't make any real difference. Still, the masks are really there for one particular case that hasn't happened yet. What if whatever causes the aircraft to depressurize also makes it hard for the pilots to get the plane quickly down to a safe altitude? That's certainly plausible, and when it happens, a lot of people are going to be very grateful for those masks. One last feature of the briefing to talk about, the brace position. There are two urban legends I've heard about the brace position. The first is that the position is there, designed to make sure your neck will break on impact, making sure you die quickly in the event of an accident, and that you aren't left disabled, which costs the insurance companies a lot of money. The other thing I've heard is that the position is designed to protect your teeth or keep your body parts together for easier identification. The truth is that it's there to save your life, and it gets updated from experience from accidents or changes in the way we design the seats. There are really two purposes to it. It puts your head wherever it's going to end up anyway so that it doesn't move, and it puts your limbs, your fingers, your feet where they're not going to flail around in the accident, either hitting other people or getting broken, making it hard for you to get out of the plane. Of all the safety instructions, the brace position seems to be the one most worth reminding people of, and taking the time to make sure that people get it right. Many aircraft accidents are survivable. Depending on how you count them, around 70% of accidents major enough to have some fatalities still have multiple survivors. If you survive the initial impact, your biggest risk is not being able to get out of the aircraft before you get killed by fire or smoke. And having a head injury or a broken limb pretty much guarantees you're staying put. So a small difference in how you brace, and whether you brace in time, can have a big difference in your chance of survival. Next time you're on an aircraft listening to a safety briefing, remember that almost all of the boring content is explicitly required by international and national regulations. Of course, those same regulations say that the airlines should do everything they can to make the briefing interesting and attractive. This is Drew Ray for the Pod Delusion.
Now, it's very easy to bash religion, especially if you're an atheist, which is why that's exactly what's going to happen in this next report, which is by, well, me. here I am, earlier. There's no way this link could not have been awkward. Now, you may have seen in the news this week that Manchester's Jewish community have constructed the UK's largest air roof. So, what exactly is an air roof? I'll get to that in a moment. First, some Orthodox Jews obey the rules that say they can't do any work on a Sabbath. Like other religions, some people are more hardcore than others. Some people simply won't go to work, whereas others will refuse to even switch on the lights in their own home, as that breaks one of the many, many rules on what you can and can't do on the holy day. In Israel, this can be particularly problematic, as even hardcore religious people still need to live in the modern world. Lucky for them, there are many ways around the rules. Many lifts in Israel, for example, will operate automatically on Saturdays, simply stopping at every floor of a building rather than having the user press a button and thus breaking the rule about doing work. Similarly, lights are often triggered on a timer to stop people sitting in the dark. This all gets a bit silly when you extend it to its natural conclusion, with gadgets like special phones that, rather than have buttons that you press to dial a number, simply dials every digit until the user breaks the circuit using a special dialing wand, so that only the number that they want to dial is called. Essentially, the phone is working all the time, apart from when the circuit is broken, or something like that. But yes, that's right. God has disallowed doing a whole bunch of stuff, but it's fine if you cheat him with this semantic, or should that be Semitic, workaround. It's not just Judaism either. Islam doesn't allow usury, or moneylending as we know it, but some bureaucratic wrangling enables Islamic banking to work just fine. Islamic mortgages, for example, work by the bank buying the house at a price you agree with an estate agent, and then you buy the house from the bank at a higher rate, paying piece by piece at fixed intervals. It's a different way of achieving essentially the same outcome. Anyway, what about air roofs? Apparently, under Jewish law, you're not allowed to push or carry objects, like, say, a pushchair or a lawnmower, outside of the home on the Sabbath. Luckily, air roofs provide a handy workaround for this restriction. An air roof is a symbolic barrier to represent the boundaries of a home, and it's often erected around Jewish communities like the one in Manchester. It's not an actual wall, but it's a magic piece of wire that conveniently means that all sorts of modern conveniences can continue to be used, as the people inside it are technically all inside the same home, I guess. As Wikipedia says, an eruv allows the religious Jews to, amongst other things, carry keys, tissues, medicines and babies with them, and use strollers and canes, all because of a series of telegraph poles linked by wire. The new one in Manchester isn't the first in the UK either. There's loads, including at least three in London. I know what you're thinking. This is ridiculous! From the perspective of someone who's non-religious, doesn't this really show up the absurdity of religious belief? The Torah has been essentially retconned to make it more palatable to modern audiences. It's a bit like when Iron Man's origin story was set in Afghanistan instead of Vietnam, or Tintin was made less racist. Sure, religions do this all the time. You know, all this nasty stuff in the Bible, no, we can only ignore that bit and only listen to the nice stuff, they say. But the magic string as a manifestation of the belief? That's a bit weird, isn't it? There's surely a fine line between unquestioning ritual and active belief, but who'd have thought that that line would be suspended from telegraph poles around the suburbs? It's not like the boundary is small either, such as around the edges of someone's garden or even a street. The Manchester air roof apparently has a perimeter of 13 miles. Just how big can one be before God realises that someone's taking the piss? Wait, hang on a minute. Maybe this explains Israel's building of the wall on the West Bank. Maybe it's just the first stage in a giant air roof, so Orthodox Jews nationwide can go shopping and push their trolleys on Saturdays. It must surely be tricky to get your head around the cognitive dissonance of the Torah saying one thing and the rules being bent well beyond the original intention on the other. And okay, perhaps it's a little bit unfair to pick on Erevim. That's what they are in plural, and call them absurd. You know, because other religions have the wine is literally Jesus' blood. But it is another amusing highlight of the endless tension between religious belief and everyone realising that some of that ancient wisdom isn't quite so useful in the modern world. For the Pod Delusion, I'm James O'Malley. Now, the NHS are apparently planning to share our data in some interesting new ways, but nobody noticed because we were all too worried about Jeremy Hunt ruining the whole damn thing in the first place. But is all this data sharing a good idea? Here's Adam Jacobs explaining his take.
You may have had a leaflet through your door recently about a new massive government IT project called Care.Data. If you have, you might not have realised it was about Care.Data, as the leaflet doesn't actually tell you that that's what the plan is called. You might not even have read the leaflet. It's just a leaflet shoved through your door, not sent to you in a personally addressed letter or anything like that. You might have thrown it out, unread, along with all the pizza delivery leaflets. But if you haven't thrown it out yet, I'd encourage you to read it carefully. It's quite important stuff, though there are a few problems with the leaflet, which I'll come back to in a bit. But first, what is Care.Data? Well, it's a new database that's being created by the Health and Social Care Information Centre, a public body that was set up by the Health and Social Care Act 2012, a piece of legislation which I think we covered on the Pod Delusion more than once before when it was going through Parliament. But at the time, I think we were probably focusing a bit too much on opening up the NHS to private sector providers to notice that the Act also contained some pretty important stuff about the way your medical records are shared. The database will contain medical records from primary care. Your GP will be asked to upload your records to the system. The data uploaded to the central database won't include your name, but it will include your date of birth, NHS number, sex and postcode, so you will be personally identifiable from the record. There are undoubtedly many benefits to be had from this system. It's really serving two purposes. First, it allows the NHS to get better data on what it's actually doing, which should help it to plan its services better. It will also be possible to link data from the primary care records to secondary care records, which should allow a more complete understanding of patient pathways within the NHS than is currently possible. Second, the data will be available to researchers. It will no doubt be a fantastic resource for anyone wanting to do research on the care patients receive and their outcomes in primary care. One other use of the system, which may not be welcomed by everyone, is that the data will also be available to private sector healthcare providers, such as Virgin Care or Serco. The data will no doubt be very useful to them when they're bidding for outsourced NHS services, helping them to run rings around NHS procurement managers. Good news if you're a shareholder in a private healthcare company, not such good news if you're a taxpayer or a patient with expensive needs. So the system has benefits, but of course it also has costs. Great big government database systems don't come cheap. So do the benefits outweigh the costs? I'd love to be able to tell you the answer to that, but I can't, for the simple reason that the costs are a closely guarded secret. GP Dr. Neil Bhatia, who's taken a keen interest in Care.Data, tried to find out via a Freedom of Information request, but the request was refused. That's a bit odd, don't you think? After all, the government are always telling us that if you've nothing to hide, you've nothing to fear. Incidentally, Dr. Bhatia has also produced a very helpful website about Care.Data, which you can find at care-data.info. It's worth a read. Anyway, I said I'd come back to the leaflet. It has a big title on the front page saying, "Better information means better care." I think that's a bit misleading. Care.Data is absolutely not used as part of patient care. It is not a system for clinicians to share information about individual patients to make sure they are caring for them correctly. It's purely about statistical information. Sure, good use of statistics can lead to general improvements in care, but I doubt that that's how the man on the Clapham omnibus would interpret the title of the leaflet. Inside the leaflet is a brief statement saying that your choice about whether to opt out of the system will not affect the care you receive, but I really don't think that's sufficiently clear information, and I suspect it will be widely misunderstood. The tone of the leaflet is overwhelmingly positive. It tells you a lot about the benefits of the system, but says little of the risks. The main risk, of course, is to the privacy and confidentiality of your medical records. The leaflet tells us that the data will be stored securely. Right. A giant government-run database with confidential personal data. Forgive me if I'm not completely reassured. Remember when the entire child benefit database got downloaded onto a couple of CDs and lost in the post back in 2007? But even if government IT bods have learned from that mistake and the database really is secure, that doesn't mean there's no risk to your privacy. The data may be released to third parties in one of three forms: anonymised, potentially identifiable, and identifiable. It's probably okay to share anonymised data. Anonymising medical records isn't just as simple as removing your name. If you have a rare disease, then simply knowing your diagnosis and one or two other seemingly innocuous pieces of information may be enough to identify you. But I think that's been thought of. I haven't managed to find a detailed definition of anonymised data, but they do mention small numbers of patients with rare characteristics in the brief definition I saw, so probably no one is going to know it's you from the anonymised data. Potentially identifiable data doesn't include your date of birth or postcode, but as far as I can tell, it does include most other things. Potentially identifiable is probably a pretty good description. Mostly, you won't be personally identified from that dataset, but it can't be ruled out, particularly if you have a rare disease. Potentially identifiable data will be shared with a wide range of researchers, although they will be required to keep the data confidential. Finally, the full dataset, including your personal identifiers, may also be shared. This will, apparently, only be done under exceptional circumstances and requires approval from the Secretary of State. However, the definition of what counts as exceptional circumstances is a bit nebulous. It has to be to improve patient care or be in the public interest, but I imagine you could think up quite a few circumstances where those things might apply. It's often true that rules set up only for exceptional circumstances tend to become rather non-exceptional. In fact, you may remember my talking about the UK Biobank project in Pod Delusion episode 130, where confidential NHS data was shared without consent because it was deemed to be in the public interest. You can, if you wish, opt out of having your data uploaded to the system. You need to get in touch with your GP's surgery to do this. If you're lucky, they may have an opt-out form, but it's more likely that an inquiry about how to opt out will be met, as mine was at my own GP's surgery, with a quizzical stare. After a little discussion, they seemed to think that if I put my wishes in writing and a letter, then they'd probably figure out a way to act on them. I shall be opting out, mainly because I'm really not comfortable with the idea of my identifiable medical records being shared with unknown entities just because someone managed to persuade the Secretary of State that it was in a good cause. What really bothers me about care.data is that it breaches the fundamental ethical principle of informed consent. Consent will be assumed. You have to actively opt out. If you do nothing, then your records will be included in the system. I'm always a little wary of assumed consent, though I appreciate that you can sometimes make a case for why it's a good idea, and I don't see this as a clear case when assumed consent is wholly inappropriate. But that consent does need to be properly informed. Telling patients about the system via a leaflet that may very well not be read, and which appears to be designed more to persuade than inform, does not strike me as a way to ensure that consent is informed consent. This has been Adam Jacobs for the Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, here's Vicky Stiles, looking at two intriguing new history projects. Here's Vicky with more.
I'm very kindly being allowed to abuse this platform to tell you all about two projects in public history, one of which is big and worthy and exciting, and the other which is, well, mine. At least until I wrote more people into it. In proper grown-up news, the Imperial War Museum has started Operation War Diary. This uses the war diaries, so the official logbooks, of British infantry and cavalry units on the Western Front, which have been digitised by the National Archives. Now, digitisation of stacks of material such as this is of enormous benefit to historians, but it's only half the battle when it comes to making information accessible. Another big step is the comprehensive and meaningful cataloguing of material. There's a reason why so many histories rely on official sources, so government papers and so on. Not only are they rightly considered important, but they're also relatively well organised, well catalogued, and give you a fighting chance of actually finding what you're looking for. Meanwhile, there's tons and tons of other archival material, measured in kilometres of shelving, which would shed light on all kinds of questions about our past, but which is unlikely to get used because no one has a clear idea of what's there, and sorting through it takes more person hours than most projects can allow for. So that's the starting point of Operation War Diary. It uses the Zooniverse platform, which, as many of you may know, is being used by citizen astronomers to help classify galaxies, identify particular light patterns, and all sorts of other things that humans can do to images far better than computers can. Through the website, the Imperial War Museum and the National Archives are harnessing the volunteer nerd power of citizen historians to classify pages of war diaries and tag information such as dates, locations, names, casualties, and so on. All of this is to turn the images, around 1.5 million pages of diaries, into a meaningful, usable resource. And all it takes to join in and help them out is an easy 10-minute tutorial. The other project I wanted to mention is a podcast that I've started called 1066 Wasn't All That, in which I badger PhD students and researchers of anything to do with the past to share a bit of their enthusiasm for their subject. They'll be talking not only about their research questions, but also the sources they're using, problems they've encountered, and some of the interesting and entertaining things they've found out, which sadly just don't have a place in the final thesis. The first episode is online now, in which Ben Wilcock from the University of Manchester talks about people's shopping habits in the pre-industrial Northwest, explains why Liverpool and Manchester were never really going to hit it off, and offers up the startling revelation that not everybody in the provinces follows London's lead. The second episode will be on Royalists and how they tried to cope with the defeat of their cause following the English Civil War. That'll be up next week. My aim is to bring all of this enthusiasm and excitement not just to other researchers, but to as wide an audience as possible. And that's perhaps the tenuous link between the two projects I've mentioned. They both do a bit to bridge that supposed gap between those who do history and the people whose history it is. That's you. That holy grail of impact that we in the arts and humanities are striving for, turns out you're sitting on it. So listen in, get involved in any way you can, and help us make some sense out of this wonderful world of ours. This is Victoria Stiles for The Pod Delusion.
And that's just about it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to over 4 years of podcast archives, including our last show of last year with Commander Chris Hadfield. That's all at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter if you're into those sorts of things. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by David Eastman, Andy Galt, Blakely Nixon, Drew Ray, Adam Jacobs, Vicky Stiles, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.